One summer night during a severe thunderstorm, a mother was tucking her little son into the bed. She was about to turn the light off when he asked in a trembling voice, "Mommy, will you stay with me all night?" The mother smiled and gave the little boy a warm hug, reassuring him, holding him for a moment. She said tenderly, "I can't, dear. I have to sleep in Daddy's room." There was a long silence. Then in a shaky voice, the little boy said, "The big sissy." Sir Francis Bacon once wrote that nothing is terrible except fear itself. Over 300 years later, President Franklin Roosevelt picked up on this theme in his first inaugural address to the nation, and he called people to courage and action when he restated Bacon's line and said it this way, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." But Jesus said, "Fear God." In fact, assuring his disciples in Matthew 10, verse 28, Jesus said it this way. He said, "Do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." Aerophobia is fear of drafts. Aurorophobia is fear of the northern lights. Graphophobia is fear of writing in public. Hydrophobia is fear of water. Nyclophobia is fear of darkness. Acrophobia is fear of high places. Xenophobia is fear of strangers. Claustrophobia is fear of confined places. Taxophobia is fear of taxes. Just kidding. Taxophobia is fear of being buried alive. And phobophobia is fear of being afraid. In Mark chapter 4, verse 4, after a day of teaching in parables, Jesus decided to leave the west side of the Sea of Galilee and cross over the sea to the east side. We begin reading in Mark chapter 4, verse 35. "That day evening came, and he said to his disciples, 'Let us go over to the other side.' Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, 'Teacher, don't you care if we drown?' He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, 'Quiet,'" or peace, "'be still.' Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, 'Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?' They were terrified and asked each other, 'Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him.'" Fear is mentioned twice in this short passage, and when it's first mentioned, it's contrasted with faith. Verse 40, Jesus said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" This event had some important lessons for the disciples, and the passage has important lessons for us as well. Verse 35 begins by saying, "the same day," or "that day." And this day refers to that which Jesus gave the parables of the kingdom. The fourth chapter of Mark is nothing but parables except for this event we're discussing at this point. It contains four or five parables depending on how you count them. So Jesus had been teaching his disciples the word, and now they would find themselves in the middle of a practical test, a test which would reveal how much they had really learned, not only on that day, but in all the time that they had spent with the Lord previous to that. Learning God's word is intended to produce faith, and faith must always be tested. It's not enough for us merely to learn a lesson. It's not enough for us to be able to just repeat a teaching. We must also be able to practice that lesson by faith. And that's one reason why God permits tests or trials to come in our lives. The Sea of Galilee is a good-sized lake. At its widest point, it's a little over 8 miles, and it's about 13 miles long. The sea is in a basin. It's surrounded by hills and narrow valleys that, in essence, function as wind tunnels. As a result of the topography, because of the lay of the land, sudden, violent storms are not unusual on the Sea of Galilee. We might say that the storm recorded in Mark chapter 4 served as part of that day's curriculum. It was the last lesson of the day. The storm would help the disciples understand a lesson they didn't even know they needed to learn. They needed to learn that Jesus can be trusted in the storms of life. And they needed to get a better handle on who he really was. Most people have the idea that storms come to their lives only when they have disobeyed God. But this is not always the case. Jonah ended up in a storm because of his disobedience. But the disciples got into a storm because of their obedience to the Lord. Several of the disciples were experienced fishermen on this very lake. And so this storm must have been especially fierce, since it frightened even these men. Verse 37 makes that clear. It says, "A furious squall came up and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped." But there were at least three good reasons why none of the men in the ship should have been scared, even though this situation appeared to be life-threatening. The first reason they should not have been afraid is that Jesus had promised that they were going to make it to the other side. May not come out and said, "I promise you this," but notice the text, verse 35. "That day when evening came, he said to his disciples, 'Let us go over to the other side.'" This was a command. Let us. Let's do this. Let us go over to the other side. Let us go is a command, a direct order. But this was also a promise. They were going over to the other side of the lake. That's what Jesus said. So since Jesus said it, guess what? That's what was going to happen. His commandments are always his authorizations, and nothing can hinder the working out of his plans. He did not promise an easy trip, but he did promise a guaranteed arrival at their destination. This is why he later rebuked them for having little faith. He had told them they were going to the other side of the lake. He didn't say we're going to the middle of the lake to drown. If they'd believed him, if they had faith in his words, they would have known that the storm would not hinder them from making it to the other side. They knew the scriptures contained hundreds of prophecies over hundreds of years that God would send his promised Messiah, that God would send his anointed one who would set up his kingdom. And though there was a lot of misunderstanding about the nature of the kingdom, and there still is a lot of misunderstanding about the nature of the kingdom, one thing should have been certain. God did not spend hundreds of years planning and prophesying about the Messiah only to allow him to drown in the middle of a lake. Jesus the Messiah, the Christ, the Lord's anointed one, had said, "Let us go over to the other side." That should have been enough to give complete confidence that that is precisely what would happen. Now, I know it's easy to stand up here and say that in the comfort of this building, but it's still true. The disciples needed to learn that Jesus was not just good at teaching and telling stories, that he was not just a good teacher and one who spoke marvelous parables. They needed to learn that Jesus was not just a healer, a performer of miracles. They needed to learn who Jesus was. They needed to learn that every single thing Jesus said was true. And they needed to learn that everything Jesus said would happen. just as he said it would happen. This is where they failed. Their faith had not yet grown that far. And there's a question for us today. Do we take Jesus at his word? Do we believe everything Jesus said? Not just about his return, not just about his second coming, not just the facts we read in the Bible. Do we believe him when he says, I have come that they may have life and that they may have it more abundantly? Do we believe that? Do we believe Jesus when he says, take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light? Do we believe him when he says, I will never leave you nor forsake you? Do we believe these statements, or are they just platitudes? Do we really believe the promises of God? Do they impact our lives? Do they bring us peace? Do they strengthen us and give us courage? Or are they just nominal? Do we just believe his promises theoretically? Do we agree in principle that they are true? Do we give lip service to them until we have to apply them in real life situations, and then we respond to life's difficulties like people of the world? Do we have no more faith, no more confidence, no more trust in the Lord than unbelievers? Oh, we of little faith. And so first, the disciples should not have been frightened because Jesus had promised that they would make it to the other side of the lake. The second reason the disciples should not have been afraid is because the Lord himself was with them. They'd already seen his power demonstrated in many miracles. They'd seen him cast out demons. So what was there to fear? They should have had complete confidence that things would be okay, that he could handle the situation, that they would not perish in his presence. But the disciples simply did not yet understand that Jesus was indeed the master of every situation. Do we understand? Do we believe that Jesus is the master of every situation? Do we always have complete confidence that everything will be okay? The disciples should not have been disturbed about the storm because Jesus said they were going to the other side, and Jesus was with them. And the third reason the disciples should not have been afraid was because they could see that Jesus was perfectly at peace, even in the midst of this storm. This fact alone should have encouraged them. It's interesting that this is the only place in the Gospels where Jesus is said to have slept. Jesus was in God's will. Jesus knew that the Father would take care of him, so he took a nap. Think of all the worries that might have kept him awake. He could worry about the religious and political leaders who were plotting against him. He could worry about his family who thought he was crazy. He could worry about the overwhelming crowds with their overwhelming needs. He could worry about the disciples he chose. He could worry about the future because he knew his destiny on this earth. Yet with all these things and many more to worry about, Jesus wasn't worried. He was sleeping soundly. He was not tossing and turning. Jesus was sound asleep in a rocking, wind-tossed boat. The psalmist said in Psalm 4, verse 8, in peace I will lie down and sleep, for you alone, Lord, make me dwell in safety. Jesus knew that. Jesus understood that. Jesus accepted that. Jesus was confident in that. The disciples should have known it too. The disciples should have accepted that. They should have understood that. And in the midst of the storm, these things should have enabled them to have confidence that they would make it to the other side unharmed. But what does that look like for us on a pragmatic level? What does that look like? In day-to-day life, what does that look like for us? It looks like peace, calm, and serenity in the midst of trials. It looks like receiving bad news of some tragedy, receiving bad news of some calamity. It looks like learning that your life is never going to be the same because you've learned that you or a loved one has just been diagnosed with something terminal, and though your heart is breaking and though you know your life will never be the same, yet you say calmly, I don't know how, but the Lord will take care of this. Now, I want us to think about this. I'm going to suggest something to you. I've never read it anywhere. This is an original thought, so buckle up. I'm going to suggest to you that if the disciples had truly believed Jesus, if they had truly known who he was, if they had really understood his identity, they would have sat there holding tightly to the rim of the boat, laughing and whooping and hollering like children on a roller coaster ride at an amusement park. I want you to think about that. Like kids at Six Flags, think about that for a moment. The fact is they had more assurance than you have or that I have at the greatest theme parks in the world, because sometimes those rides malfunction. Sometimes people get hurt and even killed on those rides. There was no such concern here if they'd truly known who he was. Jesus was with them. Jesus was in the boat. There was no way this boat was going down. Psalm 89, verses 8 and 9 says, O Lord God of hosts, who is mighty like you, O Lord? Your faithfulness also surrounds you. You rule the raging of the sea. When its waves rise, you still them. In a few minutes, we're going to sing verses 1 and 2 of the song, Peace Be Still, though it's entitled, Master, the Tempest is Raging in our songbooks. Here's a portion of the lyrics. The winds and the waves shall obey thy will. Peace be still. Whether the wrath of the storm-tossed sea or demons or men or whatever it be, no water can swallow the ship where lies the master of ocean and earth and skies. They shall sweetly obey thy will. Peace be still. Peace be still. If the disciples truly believed this, if these men had complete confidence in the Lord, there would have been no fear. Try imagining how Jesus would have responded if he had been wakened by the laughter, by the whooping and hollering of disciples as they were gleefully holding onto the boat like 12-year-old kids hanging onto the bar of the roller coaster at Six Flags. I have to try to envision that. Do you think maybe he would have sat up and smiled? Do you think maybe he would have said, I have not seen such great faith, no, not any, even in Israel? Can you imagine him smiling then after a few moments and saying, Peace, be still, and the wind and the waves calm immediately? Then the disciples say, Oh, do it again. Do it again. That's what the account should have looked like. Now the question is, what do these accounts look like in our lives? How tightly are we clinging to the flesh? How anxiously are we holding on to this world and to the things of this world? You recall the biblical account in 2 Kings chapter 6 where the king of Syria was making war against Israel, and the king of Syria would plan certain things for his troops. And eventually it became obvious that the army of Israel seemed to have advanced warning about this man's plans. Finally, the king of Syria called his servants together and asked, "Who is on the side of Israel? Who is revealing my plans to the enemy? Who is leaking secret information?" I don't know how one of his servants knew this. It seems that perhaps God revealed it to him in some way. But the servant told the king of Syria that there was not a traitor in their midst. Instead, this man said it was Elisha, the prophet of Israel, who knows even the words that you speak in your bedroom. So the king found out where Elisha was located, and he sent a great army there to handle that situation. The prophets had servants who assisted them. And the next morning when Elisha's servant arose, we read in 2 Kings 6, verses 15 through 23, that when the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city. "Oh no, my lord, what shall we do?" the servant asked. The prophet answered, "Don't be afraid. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And Elisha prayed, "Open his eyes, Lord, that he may see." Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked, and he saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. As the enemy came down toward him, Elisha prayed to the Lord, "Strike this army with blindness." So he struck them with blindness as Elisha had asked. Elisha told them, "This is not the road, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I will lead you to the man you are looking for." And he led them to Samaria. They entered the city, and Elisha said, "Lord, open the eyes of these men so they can see." Then the Lord opened their eyes, and they looked, and there they were inside Samaria, capital city of Israel. When the king of Israel saw them, and he asked Elisha, "Shall I kill them, my father? Shall I kill them?" "Do not kill them," he answered. "Would you kill those who you've captured with your sword or bow? Set food and water before them so they may eat and drink and then go back to their master." So he prepared a great feast for them, and after they had finished eating and drinking, he sent them away, and they returned to their master. So the bands from Syria stopped raiding Israel's territory. After the servant of Elisha witnessed this, after he had seen what was going on behind the scenes, any time in the future when he encountered imminent danger in the presence of Elisha, he should have turned to Elisha with a big grin on his face and said, "Oh boy, what do I get to see now?" That's faith. Because we don't see the spiritual forces working in back of everything. Because we don't see the bigger picture, it's a challenge. It's a test for us not to become fearful in the moments that we face imminent threats. At times when we encounter imminent danger, in the moments that we learn life-altering, life-shattering news. I think I haven't caught up. Let me catch up here. Getting closer. These men honestly ask if the Lord cared. "Do you care, Lord, that we might die?" Verse 38 tells us that the disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" And so when things go wrong in our lives, when we are hurting, when we're facing some extreme difficulty, do we sometimes find ourselves questioning whether or not the Lord cares? Jesus Christ, the Son of the Father, the Son of God, endured unspeakable torture for you and me. Jesus Christ died a horrific death for you and me. Does Jesus care is not the question. There's not a debate on that issue. The question is, do we trust him? Do we believe him? Do we truly take him at his word? The question is, when bad things come our way, do we immediately accept the fact that Jesus sees all things and we see so little? that the Lord sees the whole picture and that He has our best interest in mind. And for us to question Him, for us to doubt Him, is as irrational, pathetic, and faithless as the behavior of those disciples. These men had seen Him cast out demons, heal sicknesses, cure diseases, cure leprosy. These men should have been so full of faith, again, they should have been laughing like children on the joyride of their life. When they thought they were going to die in the storm, these short-sighted disciples questioned whether or not Jesus cared. And they were no doubt just as short-sighted when they thought that the real problem had been taken care of because Jesus calmed the storm. Jesus got up and rebuked the storm, and immediately there was a great calm. But Jesus did not stop with calming the wind and the waves. The greatest danger to the disciples was not the storm that Jesus had just stilled. The greatest danger to the disciples was the unbelief in their hearts. Jesus didn't calm the storm, then just lie back down and go back to sleep. He didn't just stop the wind and the waves, then ask if anyone was hurt and inquire about how much further they had on their trip. Jesus calmed the storm, then He dealt with the real problem. In verses 40 and 41, He said to the disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" That was the real problem. What would be the benefit of stilling the storm? What would be the benefit of calming the wind and the waves if the disciples failed to understand who Jesus really was? What would be the benefit of stilling the storm if the disciples continued living lives of unbelief? If they continued walking through life without trust in God? Which would be the greater tragedy? Their death that night in a watery grave, or their death years later after having lived a life without trusting in the Savior? And so when tragedies come to our door, when things happen in life that evoke fear, the question is not, why me? The concern is not, does the Lord care? The question is, what would trust in the Lord look like in the midst of this threat? The question is, how can this event refine me and glorify God? The question is, do I really believe the Lord? Do I really trust in Him who calmed the sea? If I have every confidence that everything is going to work out for my ultimate good, how will I conduct myself in this situation? The disciples' real problem was not the storm around them. The real problem the disciples faced was their unbelief within. There's something far more important than making it safely through the storm. The greatest danger is not the storm. The greatest danger is unbelief. May we keep the eternal and the temporary in perspective, lest we find ourselves acting like those who have no hope beyond the grave. The disciples looked around and they saw danger. They looked within and they saw fear, but the disciples failed to look up by faith and see God. They failed to look at Jesus and see the Lord and Master of the universe. Faith and fear cannot dwell together in the same heart. In Acts 28, the Apostle Paul's storm provided opportunities for hundreds of people to learn about the Lord. In the book of Jonah, Jonah's storm at sea came because he disobeyed the Lord. In Mark chapter 4, the disciples' storm came even though they had obeyed the Lord. The purpose of the storm on this occasion served to build the faith of the disciples. The purpose of the storm was to help the disciples see who Jesus really was. It's important to understand that the disciples were obeying yet the storm came. If they disobeyed the Lord and refused to cross the sea, guess what? They would not have encountered the storm. It's important to understand that the disciples were traveling with Jesus, yet the storm came. It's important to understand the disciples were in the center of God's will, that they were living in obedience to Him, living in obedience to Him, yet the storm came. We need to remember the benefits of storms. The storm enabled them to learn the lesson that Christ would be with them in the midst of trials and difficulties. The storm enabled them to learn the lesson that Christ would not abandon them in the midst of life's difficulties. The storm enabled them to see who Jesus really was, to understand His identity, to get closer to understanding that Christ is Lord. Christ could have taught these lessons repeatedly, but until the disciples saw them in action, they were just hypotheses. They were little more than theories to them. I read of a workman who was employed on some building project where he was working at night. He was busy on the edge of the wall, several stories high, and he suddenly lost his balance and fell, but he managed to grasp the edge of the wall with his fingers. He clung there desperately, hoping that someone would come to his aid. He began yelling loudly, screaming, but other men were operating machines nearby, so no one could hear him, and he saw nothing but darkness below. Soon he felt his arms grow numb, and his fingers began to slip, and he let out a cry as he fell about 3 inches to a scaffold that had been there all the time. I don't know how long the disciples fought fearfully against the storm before they started calling to Jesus, but Jesus was right there with them the whole time. They were in no danger because He was there. They had no reason to fear because He was there with them. Psalm 56, verse 3 says, "When I am afraid, I will trust in Thee." Isaiah 12, verse 2 says, "Surely God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid." When storm comes in your life, when storms come in my life, we should consider that the Lord will see us through these for our good. When storms come in our lives, we need to consider, how is it that this can be used to strengthen my faith? When storms come upon us, it doesn't necessarily mean that we've done anything wrong. Let us not be guilty of judging the storms in somebody else's life. Sometimes storms, trials, difficulties come because of our obedience. They come to us to make us stronger, to help us grow, to help us see the futility and the temporary nature of this world. And it needs to be said that I'm not standing here speaking pious platitudes as one who's never faced a tragedy, as one who's never been confronted with heartbreaking news, but I have suffered no more than many of you, and I've suffered far less than some of you. But I'm not minimizing, I'm not downplaying the seriousness of the difficulties we face, the horrific impact of the tragedies we sometimes encounter in this life. What I'm trying to do is assure us that we are simply not seeing the whole picture, that we have to come to grips with the fact that difficulties, trials, tragedies in this life serve to wean us from this world and point us to the next. These storms of life point us to something far greater. And we must learn this in order to handle them properly, in order to trust in the one who has promised us that He will be with us always, the one who has promised us that all things work together for our good, if we love him, trust him, and obey him. All storms can be used to God's glory and to our benefit. Sometimes the Lord calms the storm. Sometimes he lets the storm rage and calms his child. The rhetorical question comes to mind, if God is for us, who or what, we might add, can be against us? Let us find comfort, courage, and strength in knowing that the one who can calm the storm can also see us safely through the storm, the storms of life, to the other side.